It's August 28th, 2019, and welcome to Teaching American History's first Documents in Detail webinar of the 2019-2020 school year. Today, moderator John Moser of Ashland University, Sarah Morgan Smith of the Ashbrook Center, and Todd Estes of Oakland University will be discussing Thomas Jefferson's Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, one of the three things that Jefferson explicitly wanted engraved on his tombstone. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome to another episode of Documents in Detail. This is the first episode of season three of Documents in Detail. The network keeps renewing us. Detail is Teaching American History's webinar series in which we bring together thoughtful scholars to have a conversation about historically important documents. We encourage all of you joining us today to participate in that conversation by submitting questions via the chat box, which you should see at the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. We will try to get to as many of those questions as possible. Within the next week, you will receive an email with a link to request a certificate of participation, as well as a link to the archived video and audio from tonight's program. The speeches, letters, and other writings that we're using for this year's webinars are all drawn from our book, 50 Core American Documents, edited by Chris Burkett. They are also available at the Ashbrook Center's voluminous document database located at tah.org. The subject of today's program is Thomas Jefferson's Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. And to help discuss it tonight, we have Dr. Todd Estes, Professor of History at Oakland University, and Dr. Sarah Morgan Smith, Director of Faculty at the Ashbrook Center. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I like to start these things with a general question. What makes this document so important, so worthwhile, that it merits inclusion in a volume called 50 Core American Documents? Either of you may start.
You want me to? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm cutting in and out here a little bit. So let me go ahead and start. I think one of the key things about this document is that Jefferson himself, a man who did so much and is responsible for so many things and was part of so much in the early American Republic from the Revolution onward, selected this as one of three things he wanted to have commemorated on his gravestone. Of all the things he did, he does not mention being an ambassador, being governor of Virginia, or secretary of state, or vice president, or president, founder of the Democratic Party, inventor, any of those things. Nothing merits, no mention of those things in his epitaph. Instead, of course, famously, he wanted to be remembered as Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia. So this is one of three things that he thought was the most significant in his life. And I think it would behoove us to ask the question, as you just did, why is this so significant? Why is this important? I think the short answer to that, and we'll unpack a lot of this tonight, obviously, is that Jefferson himself thought it was so crucial to his own life and career, and I think emblematic of so much else that he did.
Sarah, you care to add anything to that?
Well, I definitely agree that we need to take Jefferson's estimation of it seriously. I think something else that makes it worthy of being considered one of the 50 most essential documents in American history is that it represents the culmination of well over a century and a half's worth of struggle for religious freedom in the Anglo-American political tradition. The shift of that argument from a conversation about toleration, which implies that the state has some right to define what is not true religion or acceptable religion, to a conversation about freedom of conscience and the absoluteness of that right being something the state cannot touch.
Okay. Well, let's go on to talk about the circumstances under which this was written. What prompted Jefferson to draft this?
Do you want to start and I'll join in?
Sure. So I'm not entirely sure how far in advance, I don't have the date to hand, but, you know, Virginia was a very non-tolerant colony during the colonial period, and had for several laws on the books restricting the ability of non-Anglican ministers to preach, you know, to even gather together groups of what were called dissenters, right? Anyone who didn't belong to the Church of England, the established church. And Jefferson and Madison both complain about this, you know, as young men, seeing the way that religious believers who are not able to align with the Church of England were treated by the law. You know, we both write about how scandalous this is to them. And then during the 1780s, and again, Todd, maybe you can fill in the date, you know, Patrick Henry starts to push for a bill that will actually allow the state of Virginia to collect money from dissenters for the support of, quote unquote, the Christian religion. Right. So it's Henry actually wants to build this as a pro-toleration move because the money can be diverted to many different denominations, not just the Church of England. But Jefferson and Madison seize upon this opportunity to go back to the roots of the issue and to say, no, it's not about toleration or Christianity versus not Christianity. We should really have freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. As Sarah notes, I mean, the Virginia dissenters, people who were non-Anglicans, so Baptists, Presbyterians, nearly anyone else, just faced incredible harassment and abuse sometimes when they were preaching or when they were in church. They were often, there were packs of dogs that were set loose to interrupt some sermons and some services. Rocks were thrown at some of these people. People could be fined. They could be jailed for preaching without a license. And of course, the only way to get a license was to be an Anglican minister. So this was really a problem in all kinds of ways, practical as well as ideological. And I think what Jefferson's statute tried to do, certainly worked on with his great ally, James Madison, was to try to find a way to repeal this, to push back against this, and to create a safety, a kind of realm of conscience where conscience could be protected, where dissenters would be able to worship as they wanted, where they would not have to pay their tax dollars to support a church that they did not believe in and didn't attend, and that they would also be free from harassment because of how they worshiped or what they believed. So this is really a much broader kind of move here, I think, as Sarah notes, that's not just about Christian or non-Christian, it's really a broader move that tries to make it possible for anybody to worship the way they wanted to, and to do so without having to declare their intentions or declare their loyalties, declare their allegiances, or to do so in a way publicly that could undermine their status as citizens. So it's, I think, a very broad and very importantly inclusive kind of measure that does, I think, for all the reasons Sarah noted, really try to strike a blow here for religious liberty and religious freedom in the very broadest kinds of senses.
Mm.
John.
Oh, sorry. Did you have something else to add?
I just wanted to point out that, you know, I think it's really essential that we remember, as Todd said, how vehemently the Anglican establishment in Virginia persecuted, really, non-Anglicans, right? That Virginia actually was one of the least tolerant of the colonies throughout the 18th century. And this isn't just in comparison to Pennsylvania and Rhode Island, which are, you know, known today as bastions of toleration, but even in comparison to other southern colonies like Georgia and the Carolinas, you know, it's remarkable that this document comes out of Virginia and the context that Todd was mentioning of, you know, dogs being set upon dissenters.
You just anticipated, perhaps you were looking at the question from one of our viewers, David Cedar. Virginia was non-tolerant compared to Rhode Island and Pennsylvania, for sure. But most other colonies were also somewhat intolerant from a governmental standpoint. Was Virginia that much of an anomaly? And you're suggesting that it was.
Yeah, I think, I mean, and Todd might feel differently, but I think Virginia took the enforcement of non-toleration more seriously than even other colonies where toleration wasn't on the books. But a lot of times that was just a matter of looking the other way, whereas in Virginia, nobody looked the other way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I mean, the power of the Anglican Church in Virginia was really extensive. And if you were Anglican and you were well-connected in your church, you were also well-placed politically, you were probably prominent and wealthy financially, you were then had an open door to political office and political power, and the Anglican Church sort of opened the door and made all that possible. And so the way in which the Anglican establishment was enforced in Virginia through the taxing power, as well as through the punitive power to punish dissenters, was really extremely strong. And I think that's one of the reasons why Jefferson would have been offended by this anywhere. I think he was particularly aggrieved by this because it took place in his own home of Virginia.
Who influenced Jefferson in terms of his views on religious liberty? You point to particular thinkers from England or continental Europe, perhaps?
Well, Sarah would probably know much more about that than I do, but I think in many ways, one way that I think about Jefferson's statute here is that this is really, for Jefferson, connected to everything else that he tied into rational thought, enlightenment thought, and the sort of free exercise of one's mind. I mean, Jefferson really thought that any sort of restraints on a person's mind, whether it was political thinking, whether it was economic thought, whether it was religious thought, was just simply fundamentally wrong, and that the state had no right to interfere in that at all, and certainly not to exercise its taxing or punitive powers to strike at someone for their religious views, or to hold those against them if they were trying to seek office or seek some sort of power elsewhere in society. So I think for Jefferson, religious freedom was part and parcel of all the other kinds of freedoms and liberties that he espoused. So in a very broad sense, I think Jefferson saw religion as being, again, a component of his much broader way of thinking. He wrote about this in the, I think he gave us a very enlightened or very illuminating quotation in his Notes on the State of Virginia, his famous query on religion, where he talks about the importance of every man being free to worship as they want, and how none of us are really injured in any material way by how our neighbor thinks or doesn't think. The famous quotation that he has, of course, is, "It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." Mm. So there is absolutely, for Jefferson, no way in which the way Jefferson worships and thinks what he believes should be any sort of an obstacle for his neighbor. And his neighbor should not, in his way of thinking about things, should not pose any threat to Jefferson at all. And with religious liberty, that would be the case. Everyone's thinking would be protected. You could believe in 20 gods or one god or no god. But because no one's taking your tax dollars for this, because no one is prescribing, prohibiting you from office for this, then there's really no problem with that kind of restriction. So I think in that sense, for Jefferson, the religious question really fits in very, very nicely with all the rest of Jefferson's thinking about these matters.
Mm. Sure.
I agree with that. I mean, if we do want to try and point fingers at an influence outside of his own obvious genius, I mean, we know that Jefferson greatly admired Locke, that, you know, the portrait of Locke is one of Jefferson's trinity, you know, that he had in his salon at Monticello, the great thinkers that he admired for the work that they had done. And Locke wrote, obviously, the letter concerning toleration in the 1689-1690 in the context of the ouster of the Stuarts, who were very intolerant of religious dissent, and argued for the separation of those things from politics, right? Those things that the state can control that do, you know, influence our relations with others and those that don't. So I think you can see maybe some hints of that in the letter concerning toleration, although Locke is less radical than Jefferson on that point. Also, you know, by 1786, James Madison has gone north to Princeton for college. And at Princeton, he interacts with a lot of other students from the middle colonies, especially those from the Quaker settled areas of Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And Madison is very impressed by the thought of Quakers like William Penn on this question. So I have to believe that in the context then of Madison and Jefferson's friendship, that those ideas would also have come into play and perhaps helped shape what Jefferson ended up putting onto paper here.
One of our viewers says that suggests that freedom of conscience is a much broader concept than freedom of religion. Would Jefferson have seen a distinction between freedom of conscience and freedom of religion?
I think he would probably see religion as being, again, one of the many kinds of freedoms that would fall under the broader category of freedom of conscience, because I think Jefferson also certainly believed, if we can extend to other areas, he believed, of course, that newspapers should be free to be able to print their own opinions, not simply those of the party in power or the figures in power, and so there should be a conscience of political freedom there as well. So I think for Jefferson, yeah, I would say that he does see conscience as being freedom of conscience as being the larger category, and then all these others falling into that.
Okay. Sarah, anything to add to that?
I think that's true for Jefferson. I do think we have to be careful about applying a 21st century understanding of conscience and religion as separable to this document, because in the context of the 17th and 18th century, conscience, although it applies to, you know, your moral persuasion in all areas of life, is very much tied to what you believe about the ultimate truths of the universe, right? About religious things. Mm-hmm. So whereas, you know, in the 21st century, we can talk about conscientious objectors who are not necessarily motivated by religious doctrines. In the 17th and 18th century, that moral reasoning would have been understood as religious.
Okay. Maybe we should spend some time with the text of this document. A question here from Thomas Roberts: could Jefferson have also, as noted in the first paragraph, that man was fallible and could not be trusted? Man could not be trusted to not impose their beliefs on others. I don't think I got the question there. Maybe that could be clarified by the person who asked. Let's discuss some of the arguments that are put forward here, and assessing their an attempt to assess their validity.
Can I start? Actually,
oh sure, absolutely.
So I think just to follow up on what I was saying before about the context of conscience being a religious category, just the very first sentence, whereas Almighty God hath created the mind free, right? The whole argument hinges on this idea that there is a God and that God made man a certain way and that we have to respect that creation.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hold on a second. I'm trying to see if there's another question that came up here. You care to amplify on that a bit more?
Well, again, I mean, we could argue, you know, is Jefferson, is he saying that because he has to say it in order to get the bill passed? You know, We know that Jefferson's particular religious beliefs are sort of more deistic than anything, maybe not even deistic, mm-hmm. maybe theistic. Does he really believe that, or is it expedient? But the point is, he says it in the document, and the argument that he builds depends on then this idea that this is the way the world is, right, and that there is a supernatural being or power that intended for mankind to have this freedom. right? Mm-hmm. Because if the state could just decide, oh, we think mankind should have this freedom, then they could also decide, oh, no, we changed our minds, right? But if the freedom is divinely intended, well, that's not going to change. And so we then are morally obligated to respect it in our laws and institutions.
Mm-hmm. This is something. So our very understanding of our freedom is something that is given to us by God. Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. So in a way, yeah. So that would sort of align the distinction between freedom of religion and freedom of conscience. Although Jefferson would certainly believes in the freedom to have no God, right? To mm-hmm. no respect to no God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is also, I think, a very typically Jeffersonian document in that the preamble is really the long part. I mean, it's the part that he spends a great deal of time with. It's clearly very well written. He's given a great deal of thought here to the phrasing, to the sequence of ideas, to the way he wants to set this up. And it's really a very beautiful piece of writing. Even if we set aside the ideas and things for a minute and just think of this as a piece of writing, as a piece of written work, the preamble is quite long compared to the actual enactment part here. The legal statute is very, very short, just a couple of paragraphs. It begins there, you know, being enacted by the General Assembly. But it's that whole preamble that always does great work for Jefferson. That's certainly true of the Declaration of Independence, with the famous preamble there before he gets to all the he has clauses. And I think here too, Jefferson wants to sort of walk through and set up this issue, lay out the particulars that Sarah just did there at the outset about Almighty God creating the mind and the mind following from that. And then I think he wants to go through and talk about some of the ways in which religion can be, or religious freedom rather, can be abused, and how that's a significant problem here in the state of Virginia, so significant that it needs an act from the legislature to try to correct some of these problems. So the preamble, I think, does a lot of work here rhetorically, but also in sort of laying the groundwork for his argument and for the actual statute itself. I think we should maybe even talk some more about all the things that he says here and the way that he says them, because that's going to be, I think, a key part of this document. And it certainly is the part that includes a lot of the key takeaway lines that often get quoted later on.
The impious presumption of legislators and rulers, civil as well as ecclesiastical, who being themselves but fallible and uninspired men, have assumed dominion over the faith of others, setting up their own opinions and modes of thinking as the only true and infallible, and as such endeavoring to impose them on others, hath established and maintained false religions over the greatest part of the world and through all time. What is he, what would he categorize as a false religion? That seems an interesting thing to say in a document like this. He is asserting there is such a thing as false religion. It's not, mm-hmm. it's not all religious ideas are equally valid.
Todd, do you want to take a stab at that, or do you want me to say what I think it is?
Well, I guess there are probably several ways to read that. And again, I think Sarah is a great student, a very close student of early American religious history. So I want to hear from her on this. But I think one of the things that's possible Jefferson is doing is setting up the idea that a religion that people are forced to pay money to and are forced to support ideologically, whether they believe this and believe those teachings or not, is a false religion. If you're Anglican by rule of law, regardless of what you believe, if you're forced to support the Anglican Church with your tax dollars, regardless of whether you support them in your mind or not, as an article of your faith or not, that would in fact create a false religion. And again, having established and maintained, as he says, these false religions over the greatest part of the world by force, by power, this is all part of the problem. And so I think he's distinguishing between false religion and genuine religion or true religion in terms of whether or not it is coerced from its followers. And so I think one of the things he has in mind by false religion would simply be the fact of the established church in Virginia and what that means for the power, the false power of the Anglican religion in Virginia because of the coercive element that they have.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, and I'm going to go to Sarah right after this, by false religion, he's not saying exactly that it is the doctrines that are false, but it is that it is falsely held by those who claim to believe it because they're coerced into doing so.
Right. If you're coerced into doing something, that cannot be a genuine act of conscience. That cannot be a free choice or a free election to believe in that. And when it concerns religion, then I think that would make that a false religion because it's coerced.
Thank you. That makes sense. Sarah.
I think that's exactly right. Todd said it beautifully, and I would only support what he's saying by going back up to that first sentence where it says, the coercion of the state tends only to beget habits of hypocrisy and meanness, and that these are a departure from the plan of the holy author, blah, 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 right? So the reason the religion is false is because you can't know if you really believe it if you're being coerced into believing it. You can't know if your faith is genuine or merely the product of the coercion and your fear of being punished. And this is also a civic problem, because if you cannot know your own mind on the most fundamental questions of the existence and nature of the deity and what he demands of us, how can you then know your own mind about any of the lesser but much more daily questions of how to treat your fellow citizens, right? How to behave in public, how to, whether to tell the truth in all cases, or, is it okay to cheat somebody? All of those little moral questions that make up our exchange with one another as members of citizenry fall from this set of ideas in the moral universe. And if we don't know if those beliefs are genuine, then how can we act on them?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to point to another passage here that I found striking. Our civil rights have no dependence on our religious opinions any more than our opinions in physics or geometry. Does he really think that beliefs on matters of religion are of the same status as facts of physics and geometry?
Sarah, do you want to take that?
Well, so this is interesting. I mean, he says opinions, not actions.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I do think that we need to think about, does it matter whether I believe 2 and 2 equal 4? It is 2. I can 2 and 2 does equal 4, right? But my opinion about that doesn't change it. My opinion about a religious matter doesn't change it. But then if I start acting on that religious question in a way that's harmful, Locke certainly would say then the state has a right to regulate my actions. And I believe nothing in this document indicates that Jefferson would disagree with that, right? That he's protecting the ability of the mind to sort of have all kinds of crazy ideas, which was a good thing for him, because we know Jefferson had lots of crazy ideas, right? And liked to have these thought experiments. But I think that when it comes down to how they shape our interactions with others, that's where you can start to put some regulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think too, building on what Sarah said, which I would agree with, if we read a little bit further in that passage, just beyond where John talked about there, I think what he also wants to set up is the idea that regardless of what people believe in terms of religion, 20 gods, one God, no God, whatever it might be, Baptist, Anglican, Presbyterian, that should not have any effect on their opportunity to hold political office, to serve in public positions, positions of public trust and public confidence, he says, to be called to offices of trust and emolument. He should not have to renounce an opinion or claim an opinion falsely. So I think he's interested here both in religious life, but also in civil life, because he does not believe that someone, because they're a Baptist, should ever be excluded from a civil office if they have other skills and abilities that would suit them for that. And I think he wants to note that it's whatever someone might believe about physics or geometry, whether they agree with certain postulates or theorems or things like that, that's just as irrelevant as to whether someone is qualified to hold a public office, for example, as whether they're a Presbyterian or an Anglican or a Baptist, whether they're nothing at all. So I think for Jefferson here, he wants to create a kind of landscape for both religious thought and also for political action and behavior, and to make sure that one is never a qualification on the other. I mean, it really is this idea of building this separation of church and state to protect church from state and to protect state from church here as well. Again, he's very much concerned with these ideas about being able to hold office or rise to public trust, and how religious belief should play no role whatsoever in whether someone is able to offer their services to the public if they're called to do those jobs because of their skills.
The idea of keeping religion out of government is obviously one that lots of people pay attention to today. You mentioned the other side of the equation, the idea that it is bad for religion itself to be subject to these sort of things. Could you say a little bit more about that, each of you?
Yes, Sarah, you want to go first?
I don't know that Jefferson says a whole lot more than what he hints at here, but Madison actually writes about this theme that any kind of establishment corrupts religion internally quite a bit. And Jefferson does go on the paragraph that we were in to say that it tends only to corrupt the principles of the religion which it is meant to encourage. Any kind of establishment, that is, tends to corrupt the principles of the religion by bribing with a monopoly of worldly honors and emoluments, right? So if we think about the marketplace of ideas analogy, if a religious denomination can sort of rest on its laurels and know that it's going to get, financial support, it's going to get the honor and prestige of being, the official established religion, that it has no reason to do any of the work either of keeping its house clean, right, which allows people to sort of create all kinds of trouble internally and corrupt the doctrines and accumulate power and move away from the true teachings of whatever the religion might be, or of actively trying to persuade, the people to be followers, right? So it's bad for the religion because it's not going to be doing what it's supposed to be doing, which is evangelizing, right? Creating new converts.
Yeah, I think the intermixing of the two here for Jefferson is just really problematic. He does not say that much more about that here, but we know from some of his other writings that he was very troubled throughout much of his career by what he often referred to as the tyranny of priestcraft. And he really had, this has all kinds of meanings. A little bit later in Jefferson's career, this would refer specifically to, say, New England clergy, Congregationalist clergy, who were overwhelmingly Federalist politically, and therefore deeply opposed to Jefferson and his Democratic Republicans. And yet they would get up and give essentially election sermons from the pulpit, calling on their congregants to go defeat the Jeffersonians at the polls. So he had a very specific reason for a grievance there. But I think more broadly, he was afraid that there were priests who could abuse that power, abuse their license and their rights. And I think, as Sarah noted, if you are established without having to essentially prove yourself or sustain yourself or compete with other denominations, if you were the established church and you got tax dollars to do that, then again, as Sarah notes, there's no incentive to not only try to be the best, but there's no incentive to listen to consider other points of view whatsoever. And the tendency is to lead to a kind of corruption that can then also be used to corrupt other aspects of the public sphere, be it politics, be it education, be it newspapers, be it writing, et cetera. So I think for Jefferson, again, these ideas of civic life and religious life, I think he saw as being vitally important, but it was also very important to wall off some aspects of each from the other so that they wouldn't be harmful, and that so each would be able to flourish in its own way to the greater good of everyone.
That's interesting. When I had heard Jefferson's references to priestcraft, I had always assumed that he was referring to Roman Catholicism, not to New England. Yeah. Calvinism. Mm-hmm. But on the subject of Catholicism, there's a question from a viewer. How did Jefferson's time in Catholic France influence his views on toleration, if at all?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a great question. I'm not sure if the French experience, which was so formative for him in so many other ways, had an influence here, but maybe Sarah knows.
That's a really interesting question that I now want to go do some research on to try and find an answer. I'm not aware of him talking much about religion in the letters that he writes from France or anything, but
the viewer went on to ask, didn't Jefferson even send a daughter to a Catholic convent school in France, much to the chagrin of Abigail Adams and some other?
Now that is true. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that had any impact on Jefferson's thinking on this, or if it was merely because he was already fairly open-minded in terms of, you know, not being fearful of Catholicism any more so than he was fearful of any other establishment.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I know that when those of this era would refer to monkish superstition, that was pretty much always a code word for the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Another of our viewers asks, what other state constitutions in America or the American colonies did Jefferson draw inspiration from?
Well, I mean, for my part, I think Jefferson saw Virginia, which was the most populous state, as in some ways, I mean, I think he was very... which was a egocentric, state-centric in thinking Virginia was more important than other states. Virginia contributed so much to the nation in terms of wealth, in terms of population, political power, influence, and everything else, that I think for Jefferson, Virginia would be a very important state in terms of what it did, and the influence would run from Virginia elsewhere, less so than from other states to Virginia. So I'm not sure. And again, the examples that Jefferson draws from in crafting the language and crafting the statute itself really refers very specifically to Virginia examples. It can apply anywhere. So there's a universality to the statement, but I really think it was crafted for Virginia, with Virginia in mind, to correct problems that he saw in Virginia. And I think that followed his larger political conceits, if you will, that Virginia was somehow better, more important than other states, and that therefore Virginia's example would be more important for other states as well. And certainly some scholars have argued that in terms of this, it was quite influential. Other states followed this example later on. Other states would imitate these kinds of ideas. Other state constitutions would come to incorporate some of these sorts of notions. And so in that sense, Jefferson may well have been correct that other people saw Virginia to be as significant as he did in a broader sense.
Well, this leads me to ask about the overall impact of this statute. How was it received at the time? What influence did it have within and outside of Virginia?
To answer that one.
You want me to? Well, I mean, yeah, I think in many ways, I mean, this was because of Virginia's influence and power, and because of Jefferson's known connection with this sort of movement and this drive, which he was very proud of, and obviously would be proud of to his death, and wanting to create a memory of this and what he had done. I think this does have some influence in other states. I think... I don't have the specific examples in front of me here, and it's not included with our documents package, I don't think. But certainly if you read some of the early histories of religious freedom, of the rise of American religions, there's quite a bit of influence given to this document. George Bancroft, who is a very influential American historian in the 19th century, wrote this massive history of the United States, concluded that Jefferson's preamble in particular sort of set the stage and provided a template for other states in following this example and crafting their own state documents as well. And Bancroft's books became very widely read. They were often taught in schools. Schools were taught by teachers who had read Bancroft. So certainly the idea that Jefferson deserved credit for this was widely disseminated in early America as well. There's also some evidence that, and again, I don't have a whole lot of specifics here, but that in some early court cases where religious issues came up and were deemed to be in conflict with others, that this statute was often referred to and often cited as a key part of the document or a key means of explaining and justifying the position and the importance of religious toleration and religious freedom in this case, and along certainly with disestablishing the established churches. So I think in all those kinds of ways, and I'm sorry I don't have more specifics to give you, but I think in those kinds of ways, it certainly was seen in the 19th century at least as being enormously influential in terms of its impact on other states, in history books and things like that, right throughout the century, and its direct impact on other states and what they wound up doing in terms of religious liberties as well.
Sarah?
I would add only that, again, because of the Madison-Jefferson connections, I think we could argue that the most significant influence of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom is on the drafting of the First Amendment religion provisions, right? Mm-hmm. And because we see exactly this kind of double-sided construction where the First Amendment, as we have it today in the Constitution, protects both religious organizations and institutions from governmental interference, right? Free exercise, and protects the government from the religious imposition of doctrines or ideas. So, right, non-establishment. So I think that is really, to me, the most immediate, 18th century legacy of the Virginia Statute is influencing that federal doctrine, which only applied to the federal government until the incorporation of the Bill of Rights to the states, but nevertheless created a good example that as constitutions got rewritten in the 19th century, people could look to as well.
Too, I think, of the influence of Madison and Jefferson here, and the fact that they were companions and compatriots in so many different things in terms of political history, but also in terms of this as well. I mean, I think the influence of Jefferson on the First Amendment sort of comes obviously via Madison, who was very much with Jefferson sharing that thinking as well. So I think Sarah's point there is very well taken.
What would Jefferson say about tax exemptions for churches? Would he put that in the same category with what's being forbidden under this statute?
No. And again, here my bent towards Madison is coming out. I don't know if Jefferson ever wrote about it, but I know Madison had some concerns. He ultimately acceded to it as a legitimate expression of the popular will. But from a principled perspective, he thought that religious tax exemptions were a questionable, maybe a start down the bridge to this kind of behavior.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think for Jefferson, any sort of whenever you begin to either collect money for one church or you give a tax break and an exemption to another church, that is really muddying those waters or fuzzing that line of separation that Jefferson really thought would benefit and protect both. And so, again, I don't know that Jefferson wrote very much on that at all, as Solon notes. But I think certainly if we read the language of his statute here and read some of his other writings about religion, and think about this in connection with, say, the famous letter to the Danbury Baptist and some other pieces that he wrote that, taken together, kind of give us a broader sense and a broader view of his overall sense of religion, and particularly its connection to politics. If you put all those things together, I think you can see that Jefferson would really sort of believe that any sorts of policy by a state, by a government, to influence or have some sort of role with religion, whatever it was doing, even if it were popular, would be something that would just, again, create a real dilemma.
Still, there's an implied sanctioning of something as a religion when you grant it the religious exemption from taxes, right? Mm-hmm. You have to prove that you are a true religion in order to get that. So I think that's part of the problem for Madison and Jefferson, is that then the government becomes in the business of saying, well, this is a religion, that's not, right? By deciding whether or not they're going to give out the tax break. And then conversely, the opportunity cost, of the things that the religious organization can do with the money that it's not paying in taxes, then may give it, that make it more susceptible to corruption or give it more power than it would otherwise have had.
Mm-hmm.
They're really quite, sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
Please, no, please. We're here to be you, not me.
Oh, I was just going to say, they're really quite, I think, nuanced in the way that they look at the problem, right? That there's always a both and happening, right? I mean, I think often today, if we think about religious liberty cases that are in front of the court, we tend to come down very hard on one side or the other. Oh, this is absolutely a free establishment issue, free exercise issue, or this is absolutely a non-establishment issue. But I think when we look at the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom and the way it's crafted, it reminds us that those two things actually always go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the 10 minutes or so we have remaining, I'd like to talk about how this document holds up today and what it has to tell us about perhaps current controversies. I'm struck by the very last passage in the preamble. Truth is great and will prevail if left to herself, that she is the proper and sufficient antagonist to error and has nothing to fear from the conflict unless by human interposition, disarmed of her natural weapons, free argument and debate, error is ceasing to be dangerous when it is permitted freely to contradict them.
Mm-hmm.
Can we say today that religion has improved thanks to 200 and close to 250 years of freedom of debate and freedom of religion?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you could certainly make that argument. And I think, again, that passage that you just quoted, John, is a great one, because it's also one that I think suggests a way of thinking that Jefferson held throughout much of his career. If we think about the idea there that the key, the natural weapons, as he says, are free argument and debate. Once you have those, whatever errors may creep in, however you define them, whoever might get to define them, they will cease to be dangerous when it is permitted freely to contradict them. That's very similar to language he used in his 1801 inaugural address, where he said, people should say what they want to politically, newspapers should write what they want to talk about politically, but as long as people are free to combat those ideas, to offer evidence, to offer counterarguments, then even those ideas that may seem dangerous are not that dangerous because you can refute them and you can prove to people or show people evidence as to why they shouldn't be there. I think that's a very similar sentiment that he did to what he's expressing here when it comes to the idea of religion. And again, for Jefferson, open dialogue, free debate, access to be able to speak, not putting a finger in the scale for any particular political party or any particular religious denomination. Those things are really crucial for Jefferson. And as long as you can point these things out, people should be free to say what they want, believe what they want, as long as there is also the possibility they can be contradicted by other people who believe differently and have evidence to point to support that. So I'm again struck by what will be a kind of similarity in his thinking here about religion and what he also expressed about his thinking about political debates as well.
Sarah?
I think that if we look at the way that American religious organizations have, I don't really want to say evolved, but developed in their public doctrines over time, you know, in the 19th century, you have Southern Christian denominations arguing that slavery is biblical, right? That line of thinking doesn't just go away because we fight a bloody civil war, but it goes away because there are other theologians from other regions of the country counteracting those arguments and saying, no, that's not what the scripture means. You know, we can draw these truths other places. And I don't want to say that there aren't any, but I don't know of any denominations in the United States today that are making, you know, overt doctrinal statements, you know, to say we should go back to a slave caste system, right? So if we look at this as a way of sort of weeding out bad theology through the process of debate and reason, then I think it does work over time to improve American religion.
You know, it occurs to me that I'm a Catholic myself, and I'm thinking about how Catholicism has changed in this country. There was always the anti-Catholics had a point to the extent that in the 19th century there was something subversive about Catholicism. Catholicism's relationship to democracy, for example, was very uncomfortable. Catholicism was far more comfortable with absolute monarchy and still bought into divine right. But if you look at the Catholic Church today, that element of it seems to have gone away. I'm wondering if that could be cited as an example of what Jefferson is talking about here.
I mean, I think that you have, you know, modern day Catholic integralists who would say that was a bad evolution. But I think that evolution, as it happened, the Americanization of Catholicism, that's a good example of what Jefferson has in mind here in our context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think just, too, the sheer profusion of religious sects, religious denominations, of denominations that have divided and subdivided in multiple ways over the years, whether by religious ideology, whether by sectionalism in the country. These are all, I think, examples of what Jefferson would probably be comfortable with, as long as, again, the state is not favoring or disfavoring any particular denomination or sect, is creating a kind of fair level playing field for those to, as Jefferson writes here, again, to put forward their arguments, expose them to free argument and debate, take a chance on being wrong, but be confident that the religious marketplace will correct that in some way by other people arguing against it. And so I think the profusion of not just different denominations, but again, those divisions within them would be very much what he had in mind and would probably think of as being a healthy result of the work that he and Madison and others were trying to make possible here. Not that they're predicting this, not that they were forecasting this, not that they were ordaining it, but that it simply happened as it did for all kinds of reasons. And as you know, tied into political democracy and these other kinds of questions, particular ways of immigration that increased the numbers of Catholics in the U.S., for example, all these kinds of things, I think, were only possible if you had the kind of religious practices that Jefferson wrote into the Virginia statute here. And that then, of course, through the First Amendment and so many other kinds of imitations elsewhere, became kind of part and parcel of American religious practice.
Mm-hmm. Just a last question to leave us on. we've got an audience of about 58 people out there, most, if not all of whom are teachers. Could you each very quickly give your closing argument as to why this document deserves a place in their American history or civics curriculum?
Sarah, I started. Why don't you go first?
Or not?
She may not be there.
Okay.
Well, muted.
Oh, there you are.
I'm here. What's great about this document and why we should come back to it and teach it is because I think it gives us a really beautiful example of how ideas, even if they're dangerous, have to be allowed to play out, right? Jefferson is writing this in the middle of a debate about establishment, but nowhere in the document does he say, and people who believe in establishment should be prohibited from being part of the political leadership, right? His whole framework includes the idea, even people who believe what he's against right here ought to be freely elected if their constituents want to do that, right? So I think on the one first, it's a great example of the importance of to liberty, of tolerating even ideas that are dangerous to liberty, the way Madison talks about in Federalist 10. And then the second point I would say about why it's great is the very last paragraph when the legislators make this little caveat to anyone to follow them, right? We know that it's in your purview to change this legislation. We know that, you know, subsequent legislatures might decide to overturn what we've done, but we want to tell you that we think it's a terrible idea. And I can't think of any other piece of legislation that happens, you know, where they kind of preemptively think about being overturned and try to educate the generations to come.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Todd.
Yeah, I agree with Sarah. That's well said. And I think one of the things also about this, if I were to make a brief pitch for this, the centrality of this in many ways, first of all, I think it is a brilliant statement about the necessity and the importance and the value of religious freedom, in part because it is so generally written. I mean, it's vague, I don't mean that, but there are very few specifics here that would tie it only to Virginia or only to the plight of the Baptist or things like that. In that sense, I think this is a document that I would argue is both timely and also timeless. It does apply and it grows into the particular Virginia context, which is why Jefferson struggled with this and wanted to write this. But going forward, it's also a document that is timeless because the principles outlined here speak to questions of religious freedom today, 100 years ago, in the North and South, in any number of contexts that we can think of. So I think it has a very broad applicability, and I think that's what makes this such a crucial document. Again, it's timely and timeless. And the second point, I'll simply end where I began with. This was, for Jefferson, arguably as central a framer, a founder, as there was in the United States. This was for him one of the three things that he was proudest of. And I think to go back and read this and think of this, I think we can see here why, for Jefferson, he could be pretty satisfied if he said, well, I created the University of Virginia, I drafted the Declaration of Independence, and I wrote the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. Those three things would make a pretty good epitaph for anybody. And I think if you think about the ideas connected there and the idea then with the university of perpetuating those ideas, that really gives us a key sense of how Jefferson wanted to have a great impact in his own time, but certainly to speak to and affect future generations as well.
Well, that'll be our last word. We are out of time. I want to thank both of our panelists, Sarah and Todd, as well as our participants for their terrific questions. As a reminder, you will be receiving an email within the next week, which will include a link for a certificate of participation. That email will also contain a link to the archived webinar, which we hope you will share with your colleagues and share it also on social media. Get the word out. If you have enjoyed tonight's webinar, please consider taking an online graduate course in our MAG program, the Master of Arts in American History and Government Sarah and Todd both teach in that, as do I. You can find more information about our online course offerings, as well as many other resources for teachers, at teachingamericanhistory.org. Our next Documents in Detail webinar will take place on Wednesday, September 25th. At that time, our topic will be Alexander Hamilton's Federalist One. Joining me to discuss that document at that time will be Dr. Jeremy Bailey of the University of Houston and Dr. John Dinan of Wake Forest University. We look forward to seeing you all back here on September 25th.
Thank you for listening to another TAH.org podcast. You can find archives of all our previous programs, as well as information about future programs at TAH.org/webinars, or on iTunes by searching for TeachingAmericanHistory.org.